This time I'd like to turn the program over to Dr. Liz Wagstrom. Liz and I were in Washington on Tuesday at the White House meeting on antibiotics, so this is obviously something that's gotten a great deal of attention recently. I would point out to you that this is not something that NPPC has recently gotten involved in, and if you go back and look at the history of the evolution to our current PQA Plus program, NPPC has recognized the need for producers to be responsible in antibiotic use all the way since we started making it part of who we are and what we do and why we do it since 1999. So 16 years ahead of the White House recognizing this as being an important subject. And Liz is going to run this discussion this afternoon about antibiotics, and so I'll turn it over to her.
Thanks, Ron, and thanks to all our SIP investors here. We're really pleased to have a great panel to discuss a variety of topics around antibiotics. As you realize, it's not just an on-the-farm issue. It's not just involved in what happens in the medical clinic, but we also have marketplace considerations and consumer concerns. So it's a very timely topic. We have a lot going on in antibiotics. And so I'm going to turn it over to our panel right away. We'll have each panelist speak for 10 or 15 minutes, and then we will open it up for questions. And our first speaker is Mark Williams, who's with Bader Rutter, who is a PR and communications firm that we have worked with for decades. Mark was involved in development of the other white meat as our tagline for the pork industry. So Mark's going to give us an update on the marketplace perspective around antibiotic resistance, and I'm just going to go ahead and turn it over to you, Mark.
Hello. Something that I've learned over the last few months is that it's very easy to make this subject very complicated. It's much more difficult to make it easy. What we're going to try and do in the next half an hour or so is try our hardest to make this a little bit easier to understand. So I want to start out with why are we here, and that's not a philosophical question. It's why are we convened in June in this room? Why are we talking about antibiotics today? After all, there have been concerns about antibiotic resistance since the late 60s. Antibiotics were first used in animals in the early 50s, and by the late 60s, there were already some concerns about resistance. So the first reason that we're in the room is a growing concern about antibiotic resistance and how that has come to the front, if you will, in recent time. More specifically, over the last few years, there have been development of, and finally now nearing, the requirement of the new guidelines, the new FDA guidelines. And then, as was mentioned, of course, the White House has gotten involved more recently. So within the last few months, all of a sudden, antibiotics seem to have become everybody's greatest concern or highest or greatest interest. This is a very different situation than some of the issues that this industry has faced over the last, say, decade. It is government regulated. There are specific new guidelines that everyone will have to comply with. It involves human health and food safety, so that puts it on a whole different dimension than, say, for example, sow housing. It crosses species. It's not specific to pork. There's no one particular production methodology. There are, in fact, antibiotic-free systems. There are few strong advocates for the status quo in terms of the use of antibiotics. And lastly, probably most importantly in terms of what's going to happen from here forward, is that from a marketplace perspective, the notion of reduction of antibiotics or non-use of antibiotics can be thought of or seen as a brand differentiator. So you see somebody like a Panera, this is a capture of some frames from one of their commercials, using a claim about antibiotics specifically. This, again, is something you wouldn't see a marketer making an advertising-type claim about a sow housing issue. But use of antibiotics or degree of use of antibiotics might become something that they perceive to be of a consumer benefit and therefore of value to their brand. And so now all of a sudden you have a force that's entered into this system, which is someone really wants something to happen badly because they think they're going to make some extra money out of the thing. Larger context, I would offer that, in fact, the subject of antibiotics falls into something bigger than itself, and that is, over the last several months, we've seen major brands across different sectors make significant new announcements about production-related practices. Companies like Nestle, McDonald's, of course, Taco Bell, Chipotle, Aramark. And what's interesting is that the announcements they've made have not been specifically only about antibiotics. They've been about antibiotics. They've been about GMOs. They've been about animal care. They've been about ingredients and artificial colorings. They've been about carbon footprint. And in a sense, what we've started to see is actually the press actually push back a little bit and start to ask a question whether or not these moves are actually out of conscience or are they actually marketing driven. That's actually kind of refreshing for a change to see the press pick up on something that quickly. But all of this to us is actually a part of something that's a bigger movement, if you will. That is that these brands are looking to try and fill some new need in the marketplace. And I would characterize what they're doing is making that new need being the sense of wholesomeness. And sense of wholesomeness would be characterized as more authentic, more natural, more local, old-fashioned, hearkening back to the way things used to be, the small farm. You know, those things are all wonderful images from a consumer perspective. What they'd like to see less of is artificial, factory, heavy processing, ingredients, names that they can't understand. It's the whole sugar versus high fructose corn syrup thing. And major brands have, any number of major brands in just the last few months have made significant steps in making such announcements. And it's them trying to catch up with a smaller market of niche products that have started to really gain favor. They're trying to catch up with what Whole Foods has been very successful with. They're trying to find their way to being where Chipotle and Panera have gotten to. And so big, huge brands are feverishly trying to get to this place. And they always say that they're doing it because consumers tell us that this is what they want. And consumers do if you ask the question the right way, because they'll tell you that they would, if you ask them if they would prefer to have a pork chop that was raised without using antibiotics, they're undoubtedly going to say, yes, I would. But interestingly enough, looking at a study that was published recently in Nutraceuticals World, they didn't conduct it, it was actually conducted by Experian. In 2004, this is how people responded to the question as to knowing a lot about the ingredients in the food products that they consume. And you would think, based on everything you've heard recently over the last few years, that this number's grown significantly, wouldn't you? The truth is, in 2014, the numbers are almost exactly the same. And in fact, if they've moved, they've moved to the middle. So that would suggest maybe consumers aren't really clamoring for that change as much as marketers want them to. That doesn't make it any less of a problem. That doesn't make it any less of an issue for us. The fact that those marketers are clamoring for that change means it's going to happen. So what we need to do is participate, be at the table, and make certain that we're there to help them understand the complexities of such decisions. Back to the beginning. What we're really here to talk about are the FDA guidelines and the larger issue of concerns about antibiotic resistance. This is first about the responsible. So this issue, and I've been in a lot of meetings over the last few months in which the topics of the new guidelines get very confused with a no antibiotic claim. So to keep everybody on track, today's discussion and what you should be thinking about over the next few weeks and months is this discussion is about the responsible use of antibiotics and not the non-use of antibiotics. Non-use of antibiotics is a different topic. Today, we need to focus on recognizing the need to change, and that change is part of what we've been talking about over the last 5 or 10 years with the We Care program, part of continuous improvement. There's necessary change, and everybody needs to get on board and start getting prepared to address those changes. And lastly, longer term, we need the whole marketplace to understand the implications of making such moves. They're not a simple snap. And we also need for the marketplace to understand the importance of options. There is no one-size-fits-all. Food elitism would get us to a no-antibiotic product. That's not what the marketplace needs. The marketplace needs various options, and so we need to continue to help them understand that point. Liz.
Thanks, Mark. That was a great summary of the drivers that are starting to drive us toward change. Dr. Richard Raymond is here. He's the former Undersecretary for Food Safety at the USDA, also is the Chief Medical Officer for the state of Nebraska and practiced medicine in Nebraska. So he can talk from the medical point of view about antibiotic use in human medicine and medically important antibiotics. So, Dr. Raymond?
Thanks, Liz. Mark, I don't shop at Whole Foods unless for fresh fish. I don't buy organic. I wouldn't buy raised with antibiotics unless it was the same price as conventional. I really don't care about that stuff. We can't feed the world going back to the good old days of the small farms. We just can't do that. Hunger is a bigger problem than antibiotic resistance. Unless you have pneumonia and it's an antibiotic-resistant bug, then that's a big problem for you. So we need to talk about what we can do to reduce antibiotic resistance. And the first thing I want to tell you from an MD standpoint is antibiotic resistance is growing. It's getting more and more serious all the time. USA Today had a story about endoscopes. You think getting an endoscopy is a relatively benign procedure. People are dying from that because of carbapenem-resistant Enterobacteriaceae. If you get that bug, you have a 50-50 chance of dying. And that's just from an endoscope to see if you got a cancerous ulcer or something like that. We're not talking about open heart surgery. We're talking about going in for an outpatient surgery, and people are dying in this country because of that, in large teaching facilities where they use the utmost of care to be safe. So speaking of superbugs that kill people, I want to talk just briefly about, well, first we'll start with slimed. This shows you what the media can do to your product if they decide to fight you. If it could be antibiotics, it could be ractopamine, it can be whatever you're using in your industry, you can be attacked relentlessly. And if you have one network that will run a story 23 nights out of 30, you will lose a product that's been in the business for 20 years. This is in the beef industry. Finely textured beef was used for 20 years to get approximately another 12 pounds out of every cow. Kept our ground beef leaner, kept our ground beef cheaper, went away after 1 month. The public didn't want to eat that stuff anymore because it sounded awful. And it wasn't. It was safe. It was very safe, very nutritious, helped feed the world. But it's gone. 600 people lost their jobs at the height of the recession. Now, let's talk about a superbug called MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staph aureus. And I bring this up today only because the pork industry is getting accused of livestock-associated MRSA colonizing people that work in some of the facilities where you're raising your swine. And that's one of the things the media is trying to push, and the advocates who don't want us to slaughter animals for consumption are trying to push. This is a bad way to raise pigs, and people are going to die from MRSA. Well, let me tell you this. Penicillin was first used in the late 40s, and by 1950, 40% of all hospital isolates of Staph aureus were already penicillin resistant. Penicillin wasn't used in the animal ag industry yet at that time. By 1960, 80% of all isolates were resistant. We had a real problem trying to treat Staph aureus, so we developed methicillin, which was first used in 1959. In 1960, the first case of methicillin-resistant Staph aureus was found in a human being. Methicillin had never been used in animals. Staph has an ability to mutate very quickly and form resistance. It's not because we're using penicillin in animals. This is just the nature of the beast. When fact is, we're doing a very good job of fighting MRSA with the CDC's help. Hospital-acquired MRSA is down 54% from 2005 to 2011. There have been workers colonized with MRSA, but there has not been one case of a human infection of livestock-associated MRSA in this country, ever. It's just not an issue. And I just give you this for ammunition when you're talking over the coffee table about, is this a problem with livestock-associated MRSA? No, it's not. In fact, is maybe we gave them their MRSA and colonized them. It happens all the time. This is not a new phenomenon, bacteria going back and forth from animals to humans. West Nile virus, SARS, monkeypox, you name it. It happens all the time. It's not new. So, plain old penicillin. I read in the paper all the time from some of these advocates for not slaughtering animals saying kids will start dying from strep throat again. Wrong. Penicillin is still the drug of choice for strep throat, even though we've been using it since the late 1940s. Strep didn't develop resistance to penicillin. Staph did. It wasn't because of misuse, underuse, or subtherapeutic dose, or the patient not taking their medicine. It's because the nature of the beast, and we don't understand resistance all that well. So let's talk about some numbers. These are the numbers you hear all the time. Congresswoman Slaughter, who wants to get PAMTA passed, which would take away antibiotics for control and prevention, says repeatedly that 80% of all antibiotics sold in this country are sold for use in perfectly healthy animals raised for food. And so those of you who have heard my talk before know that there is a footnote underneath every graph or every table in the annual report that comes out from FDA about antibiotic sales that says these antibiotics are also used in companion animals such as horses, cats, and dogs. And they're also used in sick animals, of course, so it's not perfectly healthy animals raised for food. I can put up with Slaughter saying that all the time, but when I read a report that just recently came out from Princeton University with co-authors from Belgium, Brazil, Canada, and other countries, this is supposedly the big thinkers of the academic world talking about the global increase in the use of antibiotics, and I'll talk about that in just a minute. But the first paragraph of this document that everybody's quoting right now says, in the United States, I quote, in the United States, antimicrobial use in food animals is estimated to account for 80% of the nation's annual antimicrobial consumption. They can't even read the footnotes. I mean, automatically, that discredits that paper. The footnote says, no, it's not just animals raised for food. So we got to fight that number. And that's that media, that's that pink slime, that's that image of 80% of all antibiotics. Liz pointed out to me earlier today, she said, you know, tetracyclines are 70% of all the antibiotics used in animals that are used in humans. And if we would just prescribe doxycycline instead of chlorotetracycline, we could cut that number down to 87% because it's all by kilograms. In the humans, I don't know about in a pig, but in a human, a dose of doxycycline is 100 milligrams a day. But if you get chlorotetracycline, it's 2 grams a day. And that's how we would measure the use. So it's the numbers, but the numbers are all we have. This is the latest report. It came out a few months ago for 2013. They've had 4 reports now. We compare report to report to report. You can't read it from back there, but right here, here's the footnote that says this includes companion animals. This year they broke it down. They changed. It used to just be all the antibiotics. Now they got it. These are the antibiotics from here up to here that are used in humans and animals. These are antibiotics used just in animals. Of all these antibiotics used in both animals and humans, 71% were a class called tetracycline. You ask your doctor, don't trust me, just ask your doctor, when the last time he or she prescribed chlorotetracycline was, and they'll ask you if they still make it. It's just not used very much in human medicine. Extremely rare cases, usually is a very poor second choice. The ionophores down this group constitute 79%, and I know that ionophores aren't big in the swine industry, but it's big in bovine and poultry. So that's a lot of antibiotics that are not used in human medicine ever. Very toxic to humans. You'll never see it approved for use in humans. There's no cross-reactivity. The Pew Charitable Trust says we don't care about ionophores. There's no science that can affect us. We care about those ones above the line. So, and I mentioned kilograms versus milligrams is a big, but it's the only numbers we have, so we have to use them with that compatibility. I don't know why the FDA insists on labeling that report antibiotics sold or distributed for use in food-producing animals. They just feed the media with a very bad label. Ionophores were 30% of all antibiotics used. They're parasitics. Not individually reported or almost all used solely in animal medicine. And tetracyclines are 44% of all antibiotics sold for use in animals. That leaves 18%. 18% of antibiotics used in animals are also used frequently in humans. These are the top 5 classes in human medicine. And I gave examples of brand names, so it might help you. I don't want to make you a doctor or a nurse practitioner, but to help you understand, penicillin, number one, by 44% of all antibiotics in humans. Augmentin is probably the most common, or amoxicillin. If you've got children, they've taken that. Cephalosporins, sulfaquinolones, and macrolides. These make up 88% of all the antibiotics used in humans. This is the 88% I think we ought to take a look at. I want to point out quinolones and cephalosporins, number 2 and number 4. comprise 0.3% of all antibiotics sold for use in animals. The FDA is doing a good job of protecting our health as humans. They have dramatically limited fluoroquinolones and cephalosporins most recently for use in food-producing animals. These are almost only used in companion animals and in very small amounts, and that's 25% of human antibiotics. What are the other antibiotics classes used in humans that are also used in animals? Again, 71% are tetracyclines. The rest of these are relatively low use in animals. And if you like graphs instead, the graph on the left, the yellow, is 82% of the total volume sold for animals. This is how much is used in humans. This is 68% of the total sold for humans. This is how much is used in animals. The only place where we really come close to being about the same is the macrolides. Macrolides are used in cattle in feedlots to prevent liver abscesses. Gets more value to return production-wise for the feedlot operator. It's not an animal health issue, but it's a you can't sell the liver and you can't sell some of the muscle where it might be scar tissue. So the producer loses a little money at the sale. So they feed a macrolide, prevents it. We have alternatives, but they cost a little more money and they're not quite as effective. It's one area where we can make some dramatic improvement, I believe. Macrolides are Z-packs. Half the people in this room are probably taking a Z-pack in their life. It's one pill, 5 days, done. Drug of choice for community-acquired bronchitis, community-acquired sinusitis, and many rickettsial diseases, and I would like to see it keep working so when I get my sinusitis, my bronchitis, it will work. I would like to see it eliminated, removed, reduced in animal use. The latest report, that FDA report I just showed you, the title page for it, just came out about a month ago. It's for 2013. It's a little late, but that's the best we can do. The actual sales of antibiotics used in animals went up 1%. Congresswoman Slaughter, the Pew Charitable Trust, Johns Hopkins University, they all said, you see, the voluntary removal of antibiotics for growth promotion just isn't working. It has to be mandatory. Liz Wagstrom was quoted, and I can't remember which paper, she says, it hadn't even got into effect yet. What are these people talking about? And I love that quote. I can't remember where I saw that, but I thought, yes, got somebody fighting for the industry. That goes into effect. Steve's going to talk about, or Scott's going to talk about that later, so I won't get into that. But to say because it went up 1%, the sky is falling down is wrong, because remember that class, those five antibiotics classes? Well, the macrolides went down 9% that year from the year before. Penicillin went down 14%. Sulfa went down 22%. The fluoroquinolones and cephalosporins, you remember, that's that little 0.3%. That's not even worth measuring. So of the five categories that make up 88% of all antibiotics used in human medicine, they all went down considerably. The only thing that went up that gives that 1% was tetracyclines went up 9%. Well, if you represent 71% of all sales and you go up 9%, you're going to see the total sales go up. Again, the important antibiotics went down. 1 year doesn't mean anything. But I hope this is the start of a trend, because this is going to get a lot easier to defend if every year we see the use of those antibiotics used in human medicine, of significant use in human medicine, going down. We're going to win this argument. This is good fodder, but you don't see this in the newspaper. You see the 1% increase, and that's all you see. So now you got some information you can take to the coffee table. So why is this change? I mean, and this is, and Mark's talked about this. This is a huge perception. Antibiotic use is growing. The media coverage is growing, growing, growing. And now we got the president involved. I mean, it's big time. Several people in the room here were at that meeting in D.C. on Tuesday. I've enjoyed listening to comments about that meeting. We'll see if we can get that in a question and answer. But I already said this is not a joke. Antibiotic resistance is increasing, and more people are dying from it. But almost all of those deaths are coming from hospital or medical facilities. They're not coming from eating pork. So it's a factor going up. So why is the community concerned about this? Well, when Chipotle and Chick-fil-A and Panera and all the Costco and all the ones that Mark already showed you say with their announcements, we're going to serve up only animals raised without antibiotics, or we're going to sell only animals raised without antibiotics not used in human medicine, or whatever phrase, however they're catching this, the average consumer has to take a look at those huge corporations with millions of dollars in assets and think, God, they must know something I don't know. They must have researched this. So I guess they must be right. And the farmers who are trying to make money must be wrong. And so they're going to go that way. The recent announcement by Costco and McDonald's that their animals will be raised without antibiotics used in human medicine, I believe is a good move, especially in the poultry industry, because it's fairly easy to do. And they're not seeing a rise in costs. They're not seeing a rise in animal wellness issues. They'll still give antibiotics when they're necessary. They just go into conventional. They don't even try to explain, but worse, they're going to use ionophores. The only label that the USDA has right now to separate those two products is raised without antibiotics except ionophores. Now, the average millennial is going to say, what the hell is an ionophore? That must be one of those hormones that give the chickens a big breast, so I'm not going to buy that stuff. So to say raised without antibiotics used in human medicine is a good marketing tool, but they can't put it on the label. They can advertise it. If you come to McDonald's, you'll only eat chicken sandwiches raised without antibiotics used in human medicine, but they can't put it on the label in the grocery store yet. So anyhow, I think the average consumer will take a look at these labels and look at the price and then decide, is it worth $2 more for this or not? There are some that will say, yes, darn right, it's good for the environment, it's good for my kids. But they may or may not be wrong, I don't know. Then we have this group of the largest school boards in the country, Dallas, Chicago, New York, Seattle, Los Angeles, all get together, say our schools will only feed poultry to our kids that were raised without antibiotics. Period. No ionophores, no antibiotics, period. Even though the supply isn't out there and even though it's going to cost more money, I don't know what they're going to do for their school board budgets, maybe cut out computer classes or something. I don't know. They're going to have to pay more money for this chicken. They didn't take that into consideration. But again, people think, well, these are educated men and women. They must know what they're talking about. And then you start getting the larger cities in the country passing resolutions that all animals in their state should be raised without antibiotics. Are they representing the average person living in the slums of Seattle that can't afford to put meat on the table? No, they're not representing their constituents at all. They're doing a feel-good thing, and they ought to be bumped out of office. Talk real quickly about superbugs, and we'll say time for question and answers. In reality, almost all superbugs, a superbug is a bacteria that's resistant to the antibiotics that are commonly used to treat the disease, period. Most superbugs come from health care facilities, one kind or another. No question about it. We do have multi-drug resistant salmonella. The recent Foster Farms outbreak in the West Coast was multi-drug resistant salmonella. More people were hospitalized than average with salmonella infections. So therefore, the media, Slaughter, Pew, and all the other ones said, you see, that multi-drug resistance is because they use antibiotics, so therefore the people landed in the hospital. It's a super bug. We need to stop using antibiotics. The truth of the matter was that the antibiotics so salmonella resistant to were gentamicin, tetracycline, ampicillin. Antibiotics would not be used to treat a foodborne illness. All of those samples that were taken were still sensitive to macrolides and ciprofloxacins and Bactrim, the three drugs of choice to treat salmonella. It was just a more virulent bug. The drugs worked. It wasn't because of the use of antibiotics that this was a bad outbreak. But that was the perception. Now we got these reports, and Mark's already talked about the PCAS report, and we got the National Action Plan, and then we got NIAA's white papers, which are really good reading material. Now we have the newest report that came out from the Tuesday meeting that we'll hear about later today, I'm sure. But these reports all keep it in the front of the public's eye that we've got a problem. This is the National Action Plan. I'm going to skip over that now so we have time for question and answer, and we can address that during Q&A if we need to. But basically, part of this is calling for advanced development and use of rapid and innovative diagnostic tests so clinicians, veterinarians, and MDs can tell if that infection with a fever is a virus or is a bacteria. We can markedly reduce the amount of antibiotics we use with better testing. When I started practicing medicine in 1973 and a kid came in with a sore throat and a fever, we swabbed the throat, sent it to the state lab, gave him penicillin for 3 days, and then found out if it was a virus or bacteria. We can do this for all infections eventually. And this one is to develop more antibiotics, possibly for use just in animals and not crossover. It's a global issue, and the Princeton report came out, I already told you about, but in their report they do say antibiotic consumption in animals will rise by 67%. They had an early report that said antibiotic use in humans had risen by 36% in 10 years. That's a problem with that kind of growing use of antibiotics. With that, Liz, I'll pass it back over to you.
Thank you, Dr. Raymond, and I know we've got a lot of information presented that will be fodder for questions later on. Our next speaker is Scott Stolick. Scott's a veterinarian who is Director of Technical Operations for the Mashoffs. Scott also was a member of our Swine Veterinarians Public Policy Advocacy class, so we've had him in to FDA a couple different times to talk about reality on the farm and how FDA actions might affect what goes on the farm, and has worked long and hard on that. And Scott's going to talk a little bit more about the changes that are coming with the VFD rule. It was published as a final rule yesterday, and by the end of next year, all medically important antibiotics that are used in feed will require a veterinary feed directive. And so I'm going to turn it over to Scott to introduce you to more of the specifics about it.
Thanks, Liz. So while Madison's pulling up the PowerPoint here, when Liz sent me an email and asked me if I'd be willing to do this, I absolutely jumped at the opportunity. It's the perfect presentation. There's no science, and it's all opinion. So I'm extremely qualified for this. So as Liz mentioned, I'm Director of Technical Operations, which, great, what does that mean? I lead all the internal multiplication, production, and health for the Mashoffs. I've also had the opportunity to spend 7.5 years as a private practice veterinarian and practice owner here in Northwest Iowa. So what you'll get from me today is really my perspective on guidances 209 and 213, as well as the recently published rule on VFDs. You'll get a veterinarian's perspective, both from a system level and from practice level, as well as a producer's perspective and what this is likely going to mean to us in the field, and really how are we going to take a system approach to the regulations. So how did we get here? Obviously, these two gentlemen painted a much better picture for you than I'm going to in the historical aspect, but you know, there's been more than 10 years of regulatory progression, going back to guidance 152 in 2003. There's this concern over bacterial resistance, some founded, some unfounded. Perceived food and human safety concerns. There's essentially at the root of all this, right, there's an erosion of trust in protein-producing industries. The consumer doesn't trust the folks who are delivering them their product anymore. Why is that? In my opinion, there's a detachment of the consuming public from their food source. In this country, between 1930 and about 2007, the U.S. population increased 240%. Over that same time span, the number of farms, what was classified as a farm in the United States, decreased by 70%. So you got two lines going in opposite directions, and that's a problem. So guidance 209, judicious use of medically important antibiotic drugs in food-producing animals. This established the recommended principles for appropriate use of medically important drugs, that being the big key as we look at how this is going to affect us in the field of medically important drugs. Limit the necessities to assuring animal health under veterinary oversight. Big deal that prevention, control, and treatment are all three still considered judicious use. So it's not a ban. It's not about not using antibiotics. It's about judicious use of antibiotics. Guidance 213, voluntary phase out of growth promotion feed efficiency label claims of all medically important antimicrobials. Voluntary is in italics because it's not voluntary. And as far as I'm aware, everybody who had a growth promotion label in the industry level has signed off. So this one's a done deal. It'll move all current over-the-counter water meds to prescription. There's a three-year window, as Liz mentioned, by the end of next calendar year. This is in full effect. So we've got about 18 months to figure it out. And the rule on VFDs, moving at the same timeline, the final rule was announced yesterday, Tuesday, something like that. And again, it'll move all OTC feed meds to VFDs as well. So going back to medically important, guidances came out and defined these four classes of antimicrobial drug rankings: critically important, highly important, and non-medically important or exempt. Why is that important? Because some of the antibiotics that we use land in the non-medically important bucket. Also, this is based on the risk to human medicine. This is not based on the risk to animals. It's not based on how we use them. but it's based on the risk of an adverse effect occurring from a resistance. So in the non-medically important bucket, just to give you some understanding of what's there, let you read those for yourself, but obviously some medications within the swine industry that we do use on a regular basis, judiciously, I would argue, and they are outside of the scope of this. So what are the implications? So disallowance of the use of medically important antibiotics for growth and feed efficiency. That does have a potential negative impact to feed conversion. We, in our system, would estimate that to be 1 to 1.5%. Veterinary feed directives required on all medicated feed products, anything with a medical important antibiotic. All new feed meds that will be approved going forward will be approved under VFD. Move all OTC water meds to prescriptions. So that's kind of what's going to happen. What does the future hold? They will collect and have been, but they'll continue to collect and scrutinize antibiotic sales use data, and they'll benchmark that. I think there's a whole lot of discussion yet to occur how they benchmark it, how is it measured, will it be volumetric to the doxycycline question, this will be an ever-increasing discussion. Again, disease prevention, control, and treatment is considered judicious for now. I think there's a big question about how long does prevention stay there? How long does control stay there? It's, again, not likely to go away anytime soon, given that there's always increasing advocacy pressure on those. And if the process stumbles or there's a high non-compliance, what does the fix look like? Was it Ronald Reagan, 9 scariest words? I'm from the government and I'm here to help. If this doesn't roll out well, what is version 2 going to look like? So the rule that was published, the final rule here on Tuesday, streamlined the VFD process. The major changes or alterations, as near as I can understand them, it does appear we will be able to list multiple sites on a single VFD, and I've caveated that by saying details still to be determined. It's heavily stated within the confines of a veterinary client-patient relationship. That's defined in most places by the State Veterinary Practice Act. In places that don't have a State Veterinary Practice Act, it's defined in the regulation. I think there's a lot of definition yet to come around what does that actually mean, how are they going to regulate against what's written. There's a 6-month expiration on the VFDs. Refills are only allowed if label approved, and there are no label approved refills today. So that's sort of a non-issue going forward. Maybe that's an opportunity. It'll be used an approximate number of animals to be fed instead of tons of medicated feed as it is today on VFDs that are out there. And it'll be electronic format rather than today's triplicate version. Interestingly, I sort of naively thought, well, hey, the government's going to give us a form because the government loves forms, and this is what we'll use for everything. And that's not the intent. The intent is that the manufacturer will supply the VFD for the particular product. Or, interestingly enough, it says that the veterinarian can provide the VFD as long as it contains the pertinent information. So I'm not exactly sure what that means, quite frankly. It sounds a bit helter-skelter to me. So I think there's a lot of definition in the next 18 months as we learn how they plan to regulate around this. So what are the impacts to the industry? And maybe these are perception, maybe they're reality. Economic impact of reduced feed conversion, increased morbidity, increased mortality. Supply and demand of feedstuffs. If the animals are converting less efficiently, what does that do to gain? What does that do to space? What does it do to feedstuffs? If we have decreased market competition through regulation, what does that do for existing products in the marketplace? And will manufacturers use that as an opportunity to increase the price of those products? One of my fears is this going to take an administrative army to facilitate. If you think about VFDs, 6-month expirations, our system has north of 500 sites. We operate in 9 states. We're going to have scripts on every water med that are over the counter now, plus any medically important feed grade antibiotic. How's that going to look? That could take quite a few folks. And back to my days in practice, you know, medicated floor stock. You know, the family that's got a handful of hogs in the backyard for an FFA project, they're not going to be able to co-op and be able to go to the co-op and get a product that has OTC in it. How's that going to get handled? So what's that mean for the producers? You know, quite frankly, we're taking away another tool from the toolbox. We are being limited on our ability to use judgment. Some of it's necessary, some of it's not. It will absolutely change strategies and feed medications. No ifs, ands, or buts about it. This will change those strategies. There's potential loss of efficiency and revenue that's going to come from that. And again, we're facing increased regulatory conditions. You know, tracking feed orders and deliveries, managing all the VFDs and scripts. Is that going to land on the producer? Is it going to land at the, you know, the feed mill, the veterinarian? There's a lot of opportunity in there, obviously. And then just documentation and maintenance of records. So from a system level, again, thinking about, you know, specific to the system I worked with and have in the past, but flow constraints, is there going to be limitations on where we place animals basis how we want to use medications in the future that we don't deal with today? Feed constraints. Are you going to need to go to just one flat feed program for every pig, regardless of health status, source, flow, finishing location, et cetera? If there's a last-minute change in the PED outbreaks, we literally were rerouting trucks while they were on the road because we found out that the barn they were going to or the barn they came from just broke a PED. And so we were literally rerouting trucks to try to keep other pigs out of harm's way. This is going to limit that. It's going to affect our ability to make those decisions. Toll mill relations and management. This is one actually that our feed team is very concerned about. If you're in a toll milling situation, who's responsible for the VFD? Who owns that? Who owns the documentation, the management, the quality assurance if there's an issue? I think this will lead to a decreased willingness and ability to change those feed med protocols. And this is not a small task. This is something that's going to take a very dedicated effort, particularly on the front side, to determine how do we plan on managing these things and getting it beyond that to a maintenance level. And what's that going to take from a staffing infrastructure to support? So from the system effects, again, the administrative support, it's going to cross a lot of different departments. And if that's an external relationship, probably makes it that much harder. Maintaining records and timelines will be critical. 6-month renewals on VFDs, turning over sites, changing flows, managing scripts. To understand when a water med script may or may not be expiring, and then specific data warehousing and notification capabilities so that you have some kind of push system that tells you this script is about to expire rather than getting a phone call saying, hey, I can't send you the product. It's Thursday afternoon. You won't be able to get it till Tuesday. That's a problem. But, hey, I'm a glass half full guy. I'm an optimist. I always have been. The FDA wants this to be successful. It has to be successful. If it's not, the FDA has egg all over them, right? So they're going to do everything they can to make this a successful program. Now, we got to help them understand how to do that, right? There is no question, if you read the VFD directive that came out, VCPR is mentioned in that thing no less than 100 times. They have the regulatory agencies, the legislative people, the consumers, the customers, they have put their faith in the veterinary profession. Now, I'm biased. I'm a veterinarian, so I get to say that, right? But it's a good thing. Veterinary oversight is a good thing. We do have an opportunity to break old paradigms. We have an opportunity to leverage technology. We'll learn new things in this process that will get us better. And at the end of the day, this industry is creative, it's resilient, it's nimble. Always has been, and frankly, I think always will be. So This is another one of those things that up front, it'll take us a little bit of time to understand it. We'll have to change how we do things. But at the end of the day, I don't expect this to flex anybody off course.
Yeah, the question is, moving forward, will future changes in antibiotic use in animal industry be based on science, biological science, or political science? That was actually my last slide. You must have read it as I've thumbed through those. And it's a quote from Ron DeHaven from the AVMA. And I think it will be based on biological sciences. I think the FDA could have gone a lot further with what they did if they wanted to base it on politics. I think they could have debated whether or not tetracyclines were medically important or not, but that would have drug it down. It would have taken another 2 or 3 years to get this done, and they knew they had to get this done or the pressure was going to be to do something statutorily. And personally, after having been in both state and federal government, I really believe policy, rules, and regs are the way to make changes rather than passing laws. Passing laws get debated behind closed doors by staffers, and you can talk to your senator all you want. But that isn't who's going to make that decision. But when you do it through policy and rules and regs, you go through years of debate. You have scientists at the table. You publish it in the Federal Register. You got 120 days for comment period. Then the agency has to go back and rewrite it to adjust to those comments, some of which probably pointed out flaws. And I think that's the process that will be followed, I hope.
So, yeah, I'm still got this on. So in my interactions on FDA listening session, there's a clear intent that they want the recording and reporting system to be very, very functional, right? They want this to work without being overly burdensome as it relates to the rollout of this process. I think my own personal opinion, as it relates to prevention, control, and treatment, I think just like this one, it's going to be played out in the political and media level before it gets to a regulatory level. And the only hope is that if you lose it on the political level, that you can regain some functional ground on the science of the application.
And I would throw out one other thing. As we've already seen, a lot of it will be driven by the retailers, by the packers, by the companies themselves from an imaging standpoint.
Sounds like a doctor.
Yeah, we actually, did the Pork Board address that in our comments to this rule, saying it's going to be a bigger burden to the small producer. They, in the rollout of the rule, said, we're not going to exempt small producers. We're going to do outreach to small producers, but we're not going to do anything to change the rule. And so it was brought up many times, and I think they balanced the need, their perception that they need to do this for public health as well as political science, with trying to come up with some sort of exemption, and chose not to. So I would say Pork Board and other organizations are going to do a lot of outreach and a lot of education, as, and we will support them in that. But it is going to be a challenge for small producers, both economically and then those with just not a lot of access to veterinary care.
Any other questions? I don't have the science behind your numbers. I know sunlight will degrade antibiotics, you know, over time, so spreading it on the fields, eventually that antibiotic is not going to be effective at all. But there's also urine and manure. There's urine running off into the rivers. Fish drink the water. We drink the water after it's filtered. Is that a risk to my health? I do not think so. But do not quote me, because I don't have the science on it. It's come up several times when I've given my talk, and I have to admit I'm not an environmentalist. I know the value of that manure. I know it'll help grow more crops, feed more pigs, and that's good. I think the real question is, what antibiotic in that manure are we worried about that might be exposing what bacterium? And how's that bacterium going to get into my lungs unless it gets drugged into a hospital when I have my surgery because somebody didn't wash their hands? I just don't think the risk is there, but and I wish I could tell you where to go find out. Always happy to give it up to Jennifer.
Thank you. That's a good question, and one that's come up a lot of times, and it's been a research priority for Pork Board for a couple of years. I can tell you, as you probably know, it's a really complex subject, like all of the antimicrobial resistance. There's a lot of different inputs that go into the environment, so it's really hard to answer it as a black and white question. That said, it's still a priority, and I can also tell you that there's just not a lot of information out there right now. It's another one of those areas where the literature just hasn't looked into it a lot. So we're continuing, as some of you have probably seen from our announcements, we have a lot of money going into research next year through the Pork Board, and that is one of our four or five priority areas in research, is to look at potential movement through the environment, what are all the different sources, and mitigation strategies for that to answer some of those questions.
Thanks, Jennifer. Now I don't feel quite so ignorant. Yes.
He's rolling his eyes, but he told me I could do this.
Well, if we learned anything from our recent challenge relating to sow housing was the opportunity of the need to be out in front of vulnerabilities that are facing the industry. Of this is one of those. And so we have been very active, Pork Board and NPPC, and reaching out to them. One of the things that this process is also, we just addressed with recently at our meeting with our packer processors and our retailers, was this subject. As a result of this, the Pork Board has some plans in place. One, we're going to have a meeting very similar to the one that we just had recently on sow housing, where we invite customers in and have a very similar panel of this, of experts coming in and explaining first and foremost what this really means, what the steps we have in place, and what we're doing as an industry. Secondly, we're going to be doing webinars, Jared. Those will be set up coming this fall, putting the webinars in place, as well as outreach pieces as ongoing communication. And so that's kind of where we're at. I mean, in regards to the ongoing communication, this, first and foremost, for us, we have to realize this subject matter that was talked about crosses a lot of species. But from pork, we have to be very honest in our discussions and the integrity of this and the fact that, first and foremost, we have no iron or force to use in the pork sector. And so we have to tell our customers that we're not poultry. We're not chickens. It's neither good nor bad. It's just the reality of the equation. And we have to be straight up front when we come to the issue of this dual use, this combination of human and that yes, indeed, the products that we use the majority of the time for prevention, treatment, control are in human medicine. You know, and so, but that's where the responsible use comes into play. And then we explain that to them because that's, and most importantly, we drive a stake in the ground that says responsible use of medication is important in the overall herd health management program. This combination of antibiotic-free and this discussion is two separate issues, and it's very easily confused in it. So that's part of the things that we're working on in the outreach effort with it. We're getting lots of calls, as you might expect, with a recent discussion that just took place in the White House and all of that is coming forward. So hopefully as a result of the methodology that was put in place for the outreach on the housing and all of that, created that framework that now allows us to leverage those relationships, the database that the Pork Board has put together to get this information out. And so Liz and Jennifer, you know, has been very good at putting the information together as a task force that we're working on this process. And so we'll be working to get that out. And more importantly, any of you who also have contact with them, we need help as well in making those contacts or information. But that's the point being, in the next few months, we're getting this information put together and we'll circulate it out. Jared, was there anything else we need to add? No?
Any more questions?
Okay.
Yeah. What about if you sort through your bills and you see the co-op delivered some CTC feed to the wrong bin and it's fed up already?
That doesn't happen.
I mean, this is where the diligence around record keeping is going to become, in my opinion, a big deal. And frankly, there's likely going to have to be more focus put on quality assurance and quality control type functions as well. Verifying medications post-delivery before bin slides are opened. Those types of things, you know, dyes added to medicated feeds, particularly if they're medically important. Those are some of the things that I think over time we're going to learn ways to manage that risk. So the question is, does the application of VFDs drive use to water solubles? My opinion only. I think that it does, simply because the ease of administration, the ease of managing a prescription versus a VFD, and the flexibility and ability to be nimble in that application. I also think that it largely is going to shift the feed medication, the standard feed medication programs away from medically important antibiotics to the list of non-medically important. I think the industry will simplify as a method to manage.
Other questions?
Well, thank you so much for attending the SIP luncheon and for all NPPC staff. We want to let you know, as investors in NPPC, how much we appreciate your support of us so that we can work on behalf of the industry. And with that, Thank you so much, and we will see you not tomorrow at SIP Luncheon, but next year, I guess. Thank you.